Hi, folks. Sam Cedar here. Another bonus episode of the Majority Report on Friday. There is a vote in the House today on Fast Track Authority, and I wanted to release this interview that I did with David Dayan for Ring of Fire Radio, which I host on the weekends, or co-host with Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy. And really interesting reporting by David Dayan on how our trade policy is developed. But I wanted to remind you folks, please, right now, call your congressperson, Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter. Tell them you are against Fast Track Authority. The vote is going to happen anytime today, and it's really important that your voice be heard. Now, here's that interview with David Dayan, who, he writes all over the place. You're quite familiar with him, I hope.
According to a recent report, the text of the TPP was drafted with the help of corporate lobbyists. Based on what we know about the trade deal, that actually makes a lot of sense. So far, we know the TPP will deliver everything that corporations have been wanting for years. But why? Well, I'm joined now by journalist David Dayan to tell us why. So, David, obviously, we've talked a lot about the Fast Track Authority, about the TPP, the TTIP, which, of course, is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And there's a third one out there, the Trade and Services Agreement, TISA, I guess, a 51-nation agreement, which recently WikiLeaks, I think it was last week, was able to leak 15 or 20 pages or documents, I should say, 17 documents related to this. But the question that has been really fundamentally asked over and over again is why would we see the Obama administration push this? And they're pushing this very hard, aren't they?
Yeah, they're pushing it very hard. And like you, I was curious about this. And something you often say, I think, to your guests is, let's go back to the beginning. You know, why do we have this situation where trade is this Trojan horse for regulatory favors, for corporate favors, benefits of all stripes? And why is it that it really doesn't matter who's in the White House, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, that they're going to be inclined to pass more and more modern-day trade deals? And so in looking at this question, I really went back and found that this is about executive power. And it's about a particular office within the executive branch that actually negotiates trade deals. And that's called the United States Trade Representative's Office. And when you put those together, that there's an office that's dedicated to writing trade deals, and that the way in which it is done is through this fast-track authority where the executive branch gets the ability to, through an expedited process, place things on the legislative calendar and get an up-and-down vote for them without amendment, without filibuster. The combination of those two things has created this trend where the U.S. Trade Rep's office is really a way station for corporate lobbyists and a way to get through things that would not pass through the normal legislative process. But they can pass inside these trade agreements, often in secretive or hidden situations, in a way that would be impossible otherwise.
I mean, we're going to go through your piece here because it really is comprehensive in terms of sort of explaining that dynamic. And we should say too at the beginning here, when I say that President Obama has gone to the mat for this in a way that, I mean, frankly, I mean, the last press reports I saw, he was going out and talking to mayors about trying to get this passed. I mean, just put that in context for us, right? Because I don't think, I mean, you and I have talked over the past 5 or 6 years about things like, you know, the stimulus, about the Affordable Care Act, about fighting for things like, the public option. I mean, things mm-hmm. that the president obviously wasn't putting his teeth behind. I cannot think of anything else where there has been this comprehensive of a push by the administration for a piece of legislation. Can you?
No, I can. I think there are a few reasons unique to this presidency, although I do think it's sort of that Washington is wired for these trade deals for a variety of reasons, many of which I just explained. But I think in this case, you have a Republican Congress and a Democratic president, and there's in the fourth quarter, as President Obama calls it, there's not much that can be done legislatively to create legacies other than something like this trade agenda, which many Republicans support. So that's number one. And number two is who's in the president's ear. And he, you know, kind of defers on these issues to his economic team, and particularly his team on international commerce, and throughout the entire administration, whether it was inside the White House through the Council of Economic Advisors or now as the U.S. Trade Representative, has been this guy, Michael Froman. And Michael Froman, he worked for Robert Rubin as chief of staff in the Clinton administration. He then went to Citigroup for almost a decade, came back, was still working at Citigroup when, under the Obama transition, he hired the entire economic team. While a senior executive at Citigroup, hired the Obama economic team, including Timothy Geithner and everybody else, then worked on international commerce issues.
Now hold on for 1 second. I want to stop you right there because I remember specifically that time in the lead up, during the transition team, where all the reasons why, I mean, and I wasn't strongly in favor of either Obama or Clinton, but to the extent that I was leaning towards Obama in that primary in 2007, it was because I wanted to avoid seeing the Rubinites in the White House. And it was during that transition time where, in fact, I think at one point, Robert Rubin was, they were looking to put Rubin back into the administration, and he had some type of scandal about taxes or something. I can't remember what it was at this point, but it basically knocked him off the docket. And it wasn't until I saw, because I did not know that Froman was a Rubinite. And that's when all of this sort of makes sense. I mean, this is like the one talisman that has existed throughout the Obama administration.
Yeah, and I mean, what was told to me by one of my sources on this story is that the few people left in the Democratic Party who think NAFTA was a good idea and generally support the modern trade agenda are in the Obama administration. And Michael Froman is chief among them. I mean, he introduced Robert Rubin to Barack Obama. He introduced Larry Summers to Barack Obama. He is the key link here between sort of that Rubinite policy axis and the president of the United States. And so having him inside the U.S. Trade Rep's office, that you're going to get a certain kind of policy coming out of that. So I guess in some ways it's not terribly surprising.
It is in some ways it's not terribly surprising. In other ways, it's absolutely terrifying because it suggests a couple of things about President Obama. And I guess at this late stage, this is the greatest. This is where that fear becomes most pronounced. But it basically suggests that Obama's not questioning this. That this is. Moses and the former Robert Rubin has come down and given President Obama the tablets, and President Obama is going out with those tablets and really pushing for it. Let's take a break. When we come back, I want you to talk about the history of these sort of trade bills, and maybe that'll give us some type of clue as to why President Obama seems to be just like some type of trade bot. Like, there doesn't seem to be any questioning of this deal. Just plow ahead and get it passed. So, David, when we broke, you were telling us about, maybe this is unfair, but President Obama's trade Svengali. This guy, Michael Froman, who was the original Citibank executive who sat on the transition team of the Obama administration and basically brought in all of the Robert Rubenites and was in fact himself a Robert Rubenite, and somehow he went away to international commerce and has come back in the form of the top trade executive in the country, who has, I guess, basically assured President Obama this is a great deal for America. And give us a sense of what, when we talk about these so-called trade deals, give us a sense, you captured it in your piece, but give us a broad perspective of sort of the trajectory of trade, where we were, you know, I guess,
sure.
But let's go back to Nixon era, maybe before then, and then where we are now when we say trade deals.
Sure. So, I mean, what I ultimately discovered here is that this is not necessarily about Michael Froman, but about a historical perspective. And in at the early days of the Republic, I mean, the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, says that Congress shall have the exclusive authority to regulate international commerce. Black and white, the only time it's mentioned in the Constitution is that international commerce, i.e. trade, will be managed by Congress. And that's how it happens for close to the first 200 years of the United States of America. After the 1930s, you know, for the first 150 years or so, Congress exclusively raised or lowered tariffs, and that was it. And the executive branch was not involved. After the 30s, there was this thing called the Reciprocal Trade Agreement Act of 1934, and Congress would set levels for where tariffs could go and then dictate to the president, okay, you can negotiate these trade deals, but they have to be, first of all, only involved with tariffs, and two, they have to be within this narrow range. And if you do all that, then you can get that through by proclamation. You can pass that deal, and it will become the law of the land at that time. So that worked for about 30 years or so, and then Richard Nixon came around. And there were some disputes, basically, over whether that tariffs were the only barriers to trade. And what the Nixon administration came up with was this idea of non-tariff trade barriers, and that this was really holding America back from creating this free flow of trade, which will have major economic benefits. And so
now let me ask you one question.
What was being negotiated during Watergate and actually wasn't passed until after Nixon resigned, Gerald Ford signed this, was the Trade Act of 1974. And what the Trade Act of 1974 said was, okay, the president can negotiate these trade deals. They can negotiate tariffs along a certain band, and they can also negotiate non-tariff trade barriers. And you can put that all together, and then we will give you a fast-track process where Congress gets an up or down vote, no filibusters, no amendments, within 90 days, so they get a guaranteed vote on the legislative calendar. And that is the way Congress will interact with trade at this time. So it's basically Congress giving up their constitutional authority to the executive branch, and that non-tariff trade barrier gradually expanded into virtually anything that, whether it's a regulatory issue or not just quotas, but everything, it started to become things that corporations couldn't get through legislatively. They could put into a trade deal and say, well, both sides on this trade deal have to abide by this particular regulation to allow for the free flow of trade, and therefore that regulation has to be weakened in the United States of America. Food safety rules, for example, were weakened as a result of trade deals. Financial regulations, Treasury Secretary Rubin and Chief of Staff Michael Froman, Glass-Steagall repeal was a trade commitment the United States made in the 1997 WTO agreement. The United States said, we will break down this firewall between commercial and investment banks. And sure enough, they did it in time for the implementation of the WTO.
I had no idea about that. Yeah. That is fascinating. And it also accounts for why Citibank must have been so convinced that this Glass-Steagall was going to be repealed that they went ahead and merged with Travelers at that time because
right.
they knew
Rubin,
this was an obligation over the WTO. And then
and
yes,
where
so
did Rubin and Froman go after getting that through successfully? They go to Citigroup. So,
well, of course.
So that this is how that changed, and the two ways Congress put in checks to this policy was, one, they said, okay, well, we should be able to have to deliver negotiating objectives through fast track. In other words, Congress can still say we would like the trade policy to look like this. The problem is they never put in any teeth to that, and so the negotiating objectives are sort of irrelevant. They do not shut off the fast track process if those negotiating objectives are not met. So they just become words on paper, really. The second thing is they said, well, we're going to set up this advisory committee system so that the trade rep has advice from a commission of experts in determining optimum trade policy for the United States. The problem is that became a direct through line for lobbying into the trade representative's office. Of the 500 odd members of these trade advisory boards, the Washington Post found that 480 of them represent industry in one form or another. It's just a complete lobbying factory. And in fact, the U.S. Trade Representative's office has just become sort of a way station for corporate lobbyists. The Center for Responsive Politics found that 144 former employees of the U.S. Trade Representative's office have gone on to become corporate lobbyists. And that includes former trade reps of both parties, whether it was the Clinton administration or the George H.W. Bush administration or the George W. Bush administration, doesn't matter. So this is what we ended up getting. We ended up getting this massive transfer of power to the executive. And then the office that does the negotiations on these trade deals has just become suffused with corporate lobbying, and that's really the only people they hear from and the only people they take advice from.
And let's be honest. I mean, they come from this world. They don't, you know, it is so deeply embedded that it's hard to even call it corruption in its narrow sense. It's corruption of our governmental process. It's corruption of our democracy. But these people actually believe that, look, the bottom line is it helps America. They just have a very narrow definition of America and
right.
of help when they say, like, we're going to extend the patents of these drugs for years to come. And that, you know,
who are they hearing from?
Who
is on the other side of that conversation? Who is whispering
Nobody.
In the ear of these executives? And the answer is that pharmaceutical companies or software companies or Hollywood or Wall Street or manufacturing organizations. And so you get a one-sided conversation.
It's absolutely fascinating. And the relationship that Obama has with these Rubinites, I don't really know how else to express it. I think it explains a lot. He really thinks that these guys are the masters of the universe. He still thinks they are, despite the fact that we saw what happened in 2008. It explains why we see no bankers in jail. It is simply that this is these are the people he thinks know best. And so folks still have time to contact their congresspeople. Stop the fast track authority, which will shine a bright light on these trade deals. And I believe stop them in their tracks as well. David Dayen, always a pleasure. People can check that piece out in the American Prospect. It is a must read, folks, a must read from David Dayen. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
David Dayen is a contributing writer for the American Prospect, the Fiscal Times, and Salon.com.